Welcome to Stoppage Time. I'm Hayden Herrera. A very special episode today as Drew Peterson and I got the chance to interview legendary basketball coach Nolan Richardson. We got to spend about an hour at Coach's Ranch in Fayetteville, and we hope you enjoy it. Check it out.
Coach, thanks for being here.
Nice being with you guys.
We're in your in the Richardson estate, and I must say, I think I speak for Drew, and this is quite a setup you got here.
It is. You know, it's amazing. You receive so many gifts during the time that you've coached, and this is a period of 43 years of coaching, you know, from high school, even junior high.
Oh, wow.
I started in junior high, so this room here with what we have is not half of what I still have.
Oh, gosh.
I haven't unpacked.
Wow.
Oh, I can only imagine. Wow. Well, I think I also speak for Drew. You know, this is a great honor to be here. We got a lot to talk about. Let's start with this season. You know, basketball season has started for the Hogs. You were at the first game against Sam Houston State. Well, what do you think of Coach Anderson's team this year? You know, it's his second year at the helm.
Well, you know, when you're starting a program like he's trying to do, you know, you got to take at least two, and sometimes three recruiting classes, mm-hmm. and put them together. You know, he came in last year with probably 6, 7, 8 players to try to play a SEC conference
schedule.
That which was really, I thought he did a tremendous job to be able to win 17, 18 games, being especially not losing but one at home. When before they were losing games at home, so that was a plus. I think what has happened, he's gotten a few more players for this coming year to go along with the 6 or 7 he had last year, and I think they're much more improved, much more.
As speaking of improved, how have you seen? You've obviously been with Coach Anderson a long time since you had him as a player at Tulsa. How has he progressed as a coach over his career? How have you seen him progress?
Well, if you look at his record, the record speaks for itself. You know, he goes to Birmingham, Alabama, program that's probably not that good.
Right.
And he gets them even into the Sweet 16. You know, in his first year, he takes a group of guys that the year before didn't win very much, and they win basketball games. And then he moves from there 4 years later, where he's on his way to Missouri. And there again, he comes in on a situation similar to the one that's here, and he takes that program and he gets to the Elite Eight. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the kind of things when you look at his record over a period of time, you can see his pattern is a winner. That's what you look at, the pattern that he has set. You know, he's going to have some ups and downs, but his pattern is so strong that it outweighs the downs, so there's no question he has. He shocked me from a standpoint of going straight out and getting those programs back on their feet.
Right. He's certainly done a great job with that.
Yeah, and one thing I've always wondered is, obviously during the season, you're focused on the games that week, the practices ahead, getting ready for the upcoming games. But how do you deal with coaching during the season and also recruiting at the same time? Is there a happy balance you do between the two, or?
Well, you have to try to get a balance. The mostly head coaches during the regular season spend most of their time trying to coach and win the games at hand.
Mm-hmm.
They get that off season in July, August, when they get a chance to see these classes, the recruiting people that you need to see. And then you got to depend upon your assistant coaches.
Mm-hmm.
To go ahead and get them to come to your campus, and then of course, being the head coach, you got to make the sale. But there's no question that every coach in this country that coaches is going to coach his team first and recruit as we go. Like I said, you have seasons to recruit, and then of course, it's a year-round process. You know, you never stop anymore.
Right.
Exactly. And also, just kind of weird. I don't know if you noticed. Past couple days have been tip off for college basketball so far. One question I'm always wondering is, do you still watch a lot of college basketball? Do you try to watch a little bit, or?
I watch a little bit. I don't watch as much here in the last maybe 5, 6, 7 years. I haven't watched as much basketball. Of course, I took on the women's basketball team in Tulsa, and then after that, I really didn't watch any men's games. I mean, when I was there, except for maybe the Razorbacks, and of course Mike Anderson. I followed him no matter where he's been. Mm-hmm. Whether he's at UAB, I went to games there. In Missouri, I went to games there. And then it just so nicely happens that he's in my backyard. And yeah. I go watch him without driving so far. But, I from time to time, especially when it gets close to the March Madness, that's when I think, that's when I miss the game the most anyway. I think I miss it during tournament time more than I miss it at any other period.
I don't think there's anybody on earth who doesn't love basketball during March Madness time. It's probably one of the best times ever. It's incredible.
Oh, yeah. It takes up our entire month.
Yeah. Oh, yes, exactly. Exactly.
Now, you were at the game on last week. What kind of feeling do you get when you walk in to Bud Walton Arena? Do you still feel like you got the whistle around and wanted to get these players out and lead them yourself?
Well, I tell you, being a coach, as long as I was able to coach, it's ingrained in you that when you see things that you want, could probably be better, or you get to see some things as a coach that you would make some changes. But every coach has his own feelings of how he would feel about a certain situation, and especially team stuff. Even though Coach Anderson does a lot of things basically the same way we did, but he's still Mike Anderson. I'm Nolan Richardson, so I'm probably more of a gambler, take chances. I'm one of those guys that no guts, no glory.
Right.
If I was a football coach, I'd probably run for 2 points every time. If I'm got 1 yard to go and we're on the 50 or the 49, I'm going for the 1 yard, because that's who I am.
Right.
Well, that's probably why I'm not in the business. But, I get that feeling from time to time the whistle, I put the whistle up, but the whistle probably never goes away from guys who coach as long as I have.
Right. Going back to this Razorback team, is there anyone on Coach Anderson's team that really stands out? Someone you wish you had on your teams back in the day that you just loved to coach?
Well, I think he's got a few players that are just really got a chance to be real good. Mm-hmm. I really am a big probably fan of Hunter Nichols. I like his demeanor of the game, his swagger, his I think B.J. Long has got a chance to be something very special. He kind of reminds me of a Todd Day kind of player. I like Scott. He's a big, strong, guard type kid in the Southeast Conference. That's kind of the protocol of having that kind of a guard to play. Powell, I think Powell, if his knee is okay, and it looks like he's moving, he's got a chance to be real special. So, the Wade kid, I like to put him like a McDaniels, to make him play, make him believe he's more of a defensive player than he is an offensive player.
You got to do that with certain players.
Some guys, they think they ought to be offensive. It's like Mac. Yeah. Mac came out of Washington, Booker T, and he led the league in scoring. He led the team in scoring. He did everything in scoring. When he got to us, we got other guys that can probably do some scoring, but we didn't have anybody could play defense on the ball like he could. Mm-hmm. So you start selling him. In order for you to play on this team, this is what you have to do to make us a better basketball team. I think that's the thing that I see.
Right.
Now, Coach, one of the things I'm kind of been fortunate with is one of the jobs I have is I work with the University of Arkansas, the athletic department. I get to be involved in the basketball players' lives a bit, helping them like going to school and academics, stuff like that. And so I'm getting to know most of the team pretty well just through things like that. Mm-hmm. And so getting to know the guys, obviously one of the players is B.J. Young, and just from a coach standpoint, obviously he's probably one of the star players on the team. Besides him and Powell, you could probably debate a little bit. But how do you, as a coach, balance the fact of him being a star player, but kind of with his ego of trying to, hey, yeah, you are really good, we need you to play, but also kind of keep him home grounded? How do you coach that?
Well, I think every coach has a way of doing things. They can do You know, I had a couple of those kind of players. I think it's important that they know who's running the show. That's mm-hmm. the biggest thing because, right. you know, the buck stops with me. You know, it doesn't stop with you.
Yeah.
And even though they say, well, they come to see me play, yeah. But you can be replaced just like I can be replaced.
Yeah.
You know, we can all be replaced. So I remember when I was a coaching in high school, I used to have a sign that says, as you walked in the door, check in your ego. You got an ego, check it in.
It's good. Mm-hmm.
It's not gonna work with me. Mm-hmm. So I think that is one of the things that I make a player understands immediately.
Right.
Who's in charge of this show? You know, I mean, I'm gonna steer the ship, and you know, you can help me mm-hmm. until I give you the directions that you got the hands on the mm-hmm. ship. You keep your hands off the ship.
Yeah, you're in charge.
Okay, I'm running the show. So that's to me is very important. And you'd be surprised. They know. Mm-hmm. They know when you don't have to say much. You know, everybody in the world of the media and is talking how great he is and all. I mean, all that's fine around him. But when he comes to me, all that you can forget about that.
Okay.
That don't count with me.
That's pretty, yeah.
That's how.
Right. Cool.
Now, obviously, there's been a couple good games so far the Hogs have had.
Mm-hmm.
Big one coming up is in Syracuse. For a big game like that coming into Boat Walton Arena, it's going to be loud. It's going to be rocking. When Boat Walton's filled and it's packed, I don't think there's a better place to play. I love it. It's incredible. It's electric. How would you, as a coach, prepare your team for a team like Syracuse, who's been to the Final Four multiple times coming into your arena? How do you prepare them for a game like that?
To me, I prepare my teams for every game. In other words, you're talking about a special game.
Right.
I don't take any game special. You see, I used to always tell our guys, it's another day at the office. If you approach games as another day at the office, you don't have those real highs and those real lows.
Uh-huh.
And that's what a lot of people get involved with. You know, oh, we're going to play Texas this week. Oh, we better get ready. Oh, we better throw this and we better do nothing but prepare ourselves like we prepared every single day for the regular season.
Right. Mm.
So when that game comes, you're prepared to play. It's just simple as that. When you know we were getting ready to play Las Vegas, the number one team in the United States, we did nothing different than we've always done. When we went to the Final Fours, you know, they give you that hour of practice. We practice an hour all the time before. When I went to that gym, I didn't put on no little play, you know, everybody does their little things.
Mm-hmm.
I practiced 1 hour. That's what we do.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's what my players expected from me, and that's what I expected from them. So when we play, I expect you to play your best game. Every game.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that's not going to happen, but my expectations is there for you to play your best game. So now you don't have all this, boy, we playing Syracuse, so what? You're playing Syracuse. You can play St. John's the next day. Who cares?
Right.
Yeah. I guess that's kind of the difference between a fan side of it and getting hyped up for the game.
Well, the fans, you know, that's what y'all supposed to do. Exactly. Hyped up and paint your face.
Take your holders and all that stuff. Yeah, exactly.
We're excited.
We're excited about the games that are going to be played because if a player doesn't have the butterflies, and you don't have to prepare a player for a tough game from an emotional standpoint. He's already up there. The ones that you got to bring him up is those games down at the bottom so you can meet that happy medium. That's why it says if you work your team every day and your expectations of your team is regardless of who you play the same, you don't have to worry about those peaks and valleys.
Yeah.
And so obviously it was just another day in the office in the 94 season.
That's right.
You know, we were 3 years old when that season happened, so I don't have the best memory of that, but my parents, you know, they saved, you know, the commemorative Coke bottles and the Sports Illustrated, know, I got to see all that stuff. So I just want to know, what was the atmosphere like in Charlotte?
Oh, man. That was, you know, those days up there, of course, that's the Final Four in Charlotte. That was the ultimate, you know. Again, you got to remember, we also went in 1990 to Denver. But I had a real young ball club at Lee. It was a sophomore, and Todd, sophomore, maybe. And we had a very young team. And I thought the team the next year, which we got to the Elite Eight, and got beat by, I believe, Kansas, and that to go to the Final Four. I thought that year we were able, we were good enough to win a national championship with that team. So sometimes, you know, I thought players on that team, position to position, was a little bit better than position to position on the 94 team.
Right.
Mm-hmm. See? So going into the 94, being there in 90, knowing that, hey, you know, it's all about getting that, just getting the victory. That's what you're there for. And focus on nothing but the things that you do every day in practice, what got you where you are. Now, don't try to get, again, too high or too low. So the fans, you know, they were, I mean, I couldn't tell you how many fans was there to support us, but there was quite a few mm-hmm. in Charlotte for that ball game. And when we beat Arizona the night before, mm-hmm. or that on that Saturday, on Sunday, there was another group wave of fans coming in.
From Fayetteville.
Yeah. And, you know, we got past Saturday's ball game.
Yeah.
So now we got another wave coming in on Sunday. Yeah. I mean, driving, whatever way, whatever means they could do it, they were getting there. And you know, and you point that out to your players, that, hey, they are here for us, baby. We got to get them something to go home with. And we got to take something ourselves home.
Right.
And, you know, so those are the motivating factors. The fans became our biggest motivators. Why? Because they were supporting us. I mean, we had like, 20,300 in the arena when we played Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, 20,000?
Yeah.
So, if you look at the, if you go back and look at the record book and count all the games that were 19 and 18, 19, 20,000, mm-hmm. it's amazing. Mm-hmm. And that was because the fans really supported Razorback basketball.
Did it feel like Duke? I mean, it was in Charlotte, so did it feel like Duke had, it was a home game for them? I mean, was there nerves going into that?
I thought, you know, they were going in their backyard. I was very fortunate. In 1980, we went to New York City, played in the Madison Square Garden. In the final game, we got to play Syracuse. I was at Tulsa University,
yeah.
And we beat them. It's the greatest feeling is to go somewhere and beat someone on their turf.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's big time.
Oh, yeah.
That's what the 94 team did. See, Duke had beaten us in 90 in Denver.
Uh-huh.
And then, it's amazing, we played Duke 2 years later in New York in the NIT semifinals and beat them 10. They won the national championship that year. We beat them 10.
Wow.
So that's I mean, we should have been there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was the difference. So, yes, going to Charlotte, playing, you know, knowing that they're going to have all their fans, we're going to have as many. But to me, our fans was as loud or louder than their fans. Because once we started making our move, well, that's all you could hear was the Razorback fans.
You were talking about Duke. And Coach K, obviously, you know, he's still there. They're playing Kentucky tonight. Where does Coach K rank among the toughest coaches that you've faced?
Well, you know, there are some great coaches. That's what I miss the matchups of coaches. There's not the matchup anymore.
Right.
You know, there's teams being matched up a lot, which is okay. But there's a lot of matchups with coaches. Dean Smith was tough.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got Krzyzewski. I think if you look at it, we played that. I think I played him three times, won twice. Played Dean Smith, I think five times, won three times. You know, you measure your program by the coaches and the schools that you play. You know, we played. You can hardly name a school that we didn't play.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we played them. If we could go home, I'd play anybody in the United States.
Wow.
But they wouldn't do. They wouldn't play me.
No, they didn't want to come to
the
bowl.
They didn't want to come. No. So, but to me, Krzyzewski has proven that he's the best from the standpoint of what he's been able to accomplish. I think he's won three NCAA championships, been to at least eight or nine Final Fours. No one has ever done as much in that category, along with John Wooden, who won all those championships. Mm-hmm. You know, he won all those championships, but if you go back and trace his record back, further back, he didn't win a whole bunch of times. Yeah. He didn't have good seasons sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, but at that period, mm-hmm. okay, Krzyzewski has over the, you know, in the 80s he was good. In the 90s he were good. In 2000 he's good.
Yeah.
You see, so he's good in every decade.
Right.
Whereas some guys are there, and then they disappear.
Yeah, the consistent. Yeah, you gotta admire the consistency.
So when you talk about consistency,
yeah,
mm-hmm. he's gotta be up there, the best.
He's way up there.
Right. Yeah.
As we've been talking, I've heard you mention obviously former players you've coached. One question I've always had is, do you still keep in contact with former players at all, or you like on
I talked to Cordes yesterday. For yesterday, he's there with.
He's coaching.
I'm trying to set. I had him send me a schedule so I'd come up and watch his team play. And I'd get some time off. Last year I went and watched a couple of his workouts. And I watched the ball game. I try to get to see him. I got guys that was my assistants and still coaching. Like Scott Edgar's got a junior college team here in Oklahoma. They went to the finals last year, almost won a national championship.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of my assistants here in Arkansas when I first got here. The ones that are in the coaching, like Todd Day's coaching over in Memphis, mm-hmm. a little team. I see Fletcher. He lives in this area. I see Beck at games from time to time. Talk to him on the phone. I had a chance to visit with Dwight Stewart. Mm-hmm. You know, Alma Martin is up the road here. I get the chance from time to time to see McDaniel. So I get from time to time to get to see quite a few of the players. Not guys who were like Tank Robinson. I mean, he's San Francisco. I would not see him.
I guess Joe Johnson's been kind of busy.
Yeah.
Joe gets him out. Then you got Pargo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's still in the NBA.
He'll call when he comes through. I think his wife's got a TV show.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, she's on that. The Wives, the Basketball Wives.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
One of them's his wife.
Huh.
Wow.
Yeah.
Didn't know that. Might start watching that. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Was there, obviously you've got to coach many great players over your time. Was there anyone that kind of stuck in your mind that was good in college, but initially you thought were going to make it bigger than the NBA, but necessarily didn't for some reason?
Well, I think, you know, you take Cordes, he was number six, man. But the guy that, to me, was Paul Pressey. And that's him right there with the Milwaukee Bucks, 25.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, Pressey defined, in other words, he changed the NBA. He changed it because he was 6'5", and he played a small forward, but he was like a point guard. Mm-hmm. So he was a forward playing like, so they call him a point forward. You know, really changed the game. Now, the thing that made him so good is that he could guard guys that were 6'9" because of his reach. You know, he had a wingspan over 7 foot.
Mm.
He had his wingspan and his touch. So, and he played 12 years. He played with the other great player from Arkansas, which was Sidney Moncrief.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, so, but he played for me at Tulsa.
Uh-huh.
Lee Mayberry didn't. He played in the NBA, but he never got the star. Came any star or anything. Todd played quite a bit. I guess the one that is the most guy that's probably done more is Joe Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's really.
And he's still
he's considered one of the best players in the NBA.
Oh right? Yes, you know? Oh yeah.
So that and he only played two semesters for me because the first semester he was ineligible.
Mm-hmm.
Then he played a semester. Then he came back. He broke his ankle or his toe or something.
Right.
And he was out for another semester. And then he played the following semester. And the next year, he go hardship.
Yeah. Not
See,
fair.
you didn't get him as much as you would have liked to.
No, he's very good.
Who was the most most coachable player you ever had? And by that, I mean, who was a player that you saw improve the most as you coached them? While they were at Arkansas, or maybe even at Tulsa?
Well, you know, I had quite a few of our players improved. See, when you're talking about improvement, then you to me you get out of an area, because there's a guy that's down here has to here to improve, and you got this guy up here who's got as much to improve, mm-hmm. and yet he's improved. Mm-hmm. But this guy, well, he's done a lot of improvement, just not as much as to get to play as much as him, but he did improve.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you see, if you talk to me, I would always go back and look at probably the worst player on our team having an opportunity to improve each year and get more playing time. Mm-hmm. See, so we had several of those kind of guys that they had more room to improve.
Right.
As opposed to guys that Scotty Thurman didn't have a whole lot of room to improve compared to the other ones. He had rooms to improve, but not compared to some of them.
Right.
So, but the one who, to me, that took the coaching from a standpoint of improving and gave up what he needed to give up in order for us to be successful was McDaniel. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a picture of McDaniel. That's my favorite picture, right there. He is so into playing defense that he's got this guy's eyes where he can't even see. He can't even see to make a pass.
Yeah.
See, now that's I said don't even let him see, Mac. And he's got a picture.
That's a great picture.
This is incredible.
Yeah. you never see that ever.
You ain't gonna never see that.
No.
So you know, you're talking about buy in. Mm-hmm. There's proof. He bought into what I'm telling you.
Here you go.
Yeah.
I might have to start when I'm playing pickup. I might have to go to Clint McDaniel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, might call a foul on him now.
Yeah.
I guarantee you, boy. He said, I ain't let you even see out to throw the ball, much less pass it.
That's
so
great.
To me, he really made a change, because he was a very good scorer in high school. And then in college, I changed his. He didn't like it at first, but as he started covering the best players and cutting their water off, as I would say, he got to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Then he would come in and ask me, Coach, can I guard the best guard on the team? Can I guard? He and Beck used to always beg for who they wanted to guard. Mm-hmm. Most guys, they just wanted to play and score points.
Yeah, right.
I had two guys talking about who they wanted to guard. That makes you
That's
feel
a good
like,
problem,
oh,
yeah.
man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, we've been talking about these players in the NBA. Did you have any desire to ever coach in the NBA?
Yeah, when I first, you know, started, I interviewed with the Atlanta Hawks. '91? It was. I couldn't leave. I had a shot to get that job, but I couldn't leave. It was Todd and Lee and O. They were going to be juniors.
Right.
You know, they had already been to the Final Four.
Yeah.
We got a chance to finally do so. So that was the biggest opportunity
right.
to move on. And I turned that down mm-hmm. and stayed. And I'm glad I did.
What's one thing about coaching college ball versus pro ball that not many people realize?
Well, you don't coach in the professional league.
Right.
You manage.
Yeah. Touché.
See,
yeah.
Because, like I said, you're talking about the college guy who has one or two egos. You got 12 egos there.
Mm-hmm.
You got 12 egos. They make more money than the coach. They have more say to the general manager. I mean, if Magic or Michael walked in and said, get rid of him, you're gone.
Yeah.
You see, so when you look at coaching, I get a kick out of it. Oh, what a great coach. Well, he's a very good manager of people.
Right.
If you get some good players together, and you know, you give them some degrees of what they need to do, and the rest of it is managing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Making sure they get along with each other.
Right. So did the Lakers call this past week? And, you know, they already got D'Antoni, but did they? They didn't call.
Oh, 70 years old.
Oh,
they
come
didn't.
On now.
You know, when you reach 70, they didn't even have none, not even a clue.
Not even for a manager role.
I mean, that's the part that I see. I don't see the NBA as. I mean, I don't just see them as coaches. You know, to me, the great coaches are in the 7th and 8th grade. To me, that's where you're teaching.
Right.
You know, when I get a kick out of it, I'm sitting up in the game, and they're yelling, block out, rebound, block out, and all that, these guys up there. Well, if I get you on my team, you better already know how to block out.
Yeah.
You know, or teaching them how to shoot a free throw. Mm-hmm. How can you come to be on my basketball team and I'm teaching you how to shoot free throws?
Or rebound.
Huh?
Yeah.
Come on. I'm supposed to recruit the kind of players that I don't have to go through that part of the game anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why I say the 7th and 8th grade, 6th and 7th grade, kids that are coming up, you learn all the fundamentals there. Dribble, pass, shoot, all the fundamentals but should be taught. By the time you're out of school, graduating from high school, if you're good, then I can just refine you. Mm-hmm. That's where all your better players are. Like, for example, who do you think taught me? Did anybody teach Michael how to jump? No. You know, you can have all these little things, these little jumping stuffs and all that, and it's a gift.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It's a gift. And so what you try to do is improve that gift. Mm. You know? So, again, it's all about when you're recruiting, hey, can that kid shoot? Yeah. Does he go after the ball on the boards? Does he, you know, that's your homework. You know? Now, you can have drills, but those drills are not going to do what he could have done game after game after game after game. And he comes to you. When he comes to you and he's been doing that already, your job is to just improve on it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, but college coaching is another aspect of the game. High school coaching, which is where I started in high school, I also started in junior high. So I had a seventh grade group, an eighth grade group, a ninth grade group. Mm-hmm. You see? And you can see the difference. So now I'm a ninth grade. Now I've become the varsity coach, and I saw this kid in the seventh grade. Boy, did I see him improve.
Right.
I remember he couldn't walk and chew gum. Now look at it.
Yeah.
You see? So that's the same thing. It keeps moving. And when you get to the college level, if you're being recruited, then that means you already got all, you possess all the things that coach needs.
Right.
You just can refine it.
Yeah.
Right. Bottom line.
I still think, you know, Nolan Richardson, system, you know, got Kobe, Dwight Howard, Steve Nash. I would have liked to have seen that.
I would have too. I think I could manage that.
There you go, yeah.
I mean, I talked about players' egos. Obviously, Kobe, you say they don't want to coach, he's going to be out. Obviously, Kobe probably wasn't happy with Mike Brown. That's probably close to being the reason why he got put out.
Yeah.
But looking around, we see, obviously, the books around. Did you get a chance to watch the 40 Minutes Hell documentary at all?
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the guy did a tremendous job because he had so much. You know, the book had come out. We sit here, you know, it was like, I bet you it was about a 3-5 month project. Mm-hmm. You know, they went around talking to people. And for him to crowd everything in, there was so much that could have been in, that wasn't in, but he was able to do a phenomenal job in my own mind, the way I saw it, in the amount of period, 40 minutes or 30 minutes of the time that he had to put on the show. You know, it was, it showed a lot of things that the average person has no clue.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They have no clue who I really am. Mm-hmm. You know, they just, oh, this is this guy that's yelling and screaming at the officials, and nobody, then they interview players who give you their insights of what they feel a little bit. Like, for example, I never knew Beck was afraid of me.
Really?
No, yeah. I never tried to make him be afraid of me. It's just that the discipline, and they see it, and that's the way I was. My college coach was a disciplinarian. So when I saw him, I knew, hey, you better straighten up or you won't be around, buddy.
Right.
Well, if they see that, then of course, then it becomes maybe a fear.
Yeah.
So when I grew up, I was afraid of the police. Why? Because they took people to jail.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't like to see that. So now, there ain't no fear of no policeman.
Right.
You know, when we used to see the light go round and round, oh my God, what have we done? I mean, it was a fear.
Yeah.
You know, I used to be afraid to walk in the graveyard. People party in the graveyard.
Yeah.
You know? The respect has changed so much, you know, that these youngsters They don't have the respect they used to. Our coaches, boy, if he said run through the wall, you just ran through the wall. You didn't even ask him why.
Right.
You can't do that anymore.
Say jump, say how high kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that quote that, you know, I think everybody remembers the Corey Beck quote where he said, you said, if you catch me in a fight with the bear, you better help that damn bear.
You better help the bear. Maybe that's why he felt that way.
Maybe so.
Because I was being very honest with him.
Right.
You know.
Love that quote.
Now, I know you've gotten to coach multiple teams throughout your career with college and high school and even some national teams. Do you still, as of now, get that itching to coach, still want to get back on their court? Still?
And for every now and then. Mm-hmm. Every now and then, you know, you see something. God almighty. There's so much into the coaching part of life that it never ends.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, to me, when it ends, then you ought to be out of the game totally. But it never ended. You know, so you always you have that urge, and then it goes away. You get that urge that you can do this because you see, and then it may just disappear. You know, you that to me is the coaching that's in me.
Right.
That's all I've done
mm-hmm.
for all those years.
That's all you know.
Yeah, that's all I've done.
On those you were coaching the Panamanian team and the Mexican team. Is that also kind of like a managing role, or are you coaching those guys?
That's a little bit different in those guys, but it's more managing than coaching because, you know, most of those guys have played in Mexico. They played on pro teams there.
Mm-hmm.
They've already played college basketball. Most of them had already played.
Right.
You're setting up. The thing that I had to try to encourage them to do, and they wanted to do it, was to run with the ball at a quicker speed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they thought they were running, and they found out, no, we don't run like you, Mr. See, so once I got them to understand that now, it's going to take a little bit of time for me to get you that kind of shape to run every time.
Right.
And, I think once I got them up and down, running the kind of basketball, then they started enjoying more and more. I think getting there was the hard part, but once we got there, and they started liking it because they found out that the more they ran and people, I had to substitute, most people got to play. Whereas when you don't have to run as much, you got seven guys. The other guys, four or five, are just practice players.
Just the bench mob.
Yeah.
Right. And I guess it helps that you speak fluent Spanish, you know, on those teams. How'd you pick it up so good? Obviously, you lived in El Paso. Is that where?
Well, when I was 3 years old, we moved out of the. We used to live in the black neighborhood, and then this highway came through and took our house. And when it took the house, we had to relocate. And when we relocated, I was a little over 3-4 years of age. We moved to a place. The south side, basically, of El Paso. And there, in the neighborhood that I lived, there were no blacks. And it's all Hispanic. And so, growing up in that neighborhood, even though I lived in the neighborhood of Hispanic, about, I would say, maybe 4 or 5 miles over, that's the school I had to go to was a black school.
Mm-hmm.
So, living in the neighborhood, learning and hanging out with my friends there. And when school started, I was in the black neighborhood. So I had two sets of friends.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so when I became a freshman, already kind of basically knew how to speak some Spanish pretty much. But when the schools integrated, I then was able to go to school in my neighborhood, which was almost 100% Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to school there from my ninth to my senior year. So I was always around Hispanic people,
right?
And so I was able to pick it up, and glad I did.
Yeah, I'm jealous. I'm half Hispanic, and I can barely
say things.
No, I can't. I wish I knew more. I really need to learn more. Now I want to ask something. I was watching TV. It was probably a couple months ago, just flipping around, and I saw the movie He Got Game. And I remember that you have a cameo in that movie.
Yeah.
You and a bunch of coaches like Dean Smith and Lou Dolson and John Chaney.
Right.
How were you approached for that role?
Oh, I got a big, I mean, that was the great, that was really a wonderful deal because what happened was, seems to me we had just won a national championship. And they brought me in. The film was filmed in Canada.
Okay.
Wow.
So they flew me to Canada.
Wow.
You know, and it was so funny. When I get off the plane, they got, you know, they I get into the airport and into the deal. They got my name there with Nolan Richson and this guy in his black cap. And then I get in this big limousine. Like, you know, like the movie star.
Yeah. You get the A-list treatment.
They put me in there, and they take me to the studio and everywhere where I'm going to be. And they give me a little room. And then the next thing I know, they give me a knock on the door and says, it's time for makeup. Damn, makeup. Wow. And they're powdering the face and all of that.
You're living the highlight.
Going to be? And I did all that for 32 seconds.
Oh, wow.
I did a take for about 100 times.
Really?
I mean, we did that over and over. I hadn't done it, you know. They just said, act normal.
Right.
The rest of the guys might have had something to do. You ain't, just act normal. Act like you're the game,
right,
and you're pissed off. I said, oh, I can do that.
Wow,
that was
awesome.
Fun.
Yeah.
And then the next, a year later, I go with Spike Lee.
Uh-huh.
He calls me.
Right.
Now, his was a little bit cheaper. See, I got pretty good pay for doing that one, but this one, it's Spike Lee, I was going to the Final Four, and he was filming there that day.
Okay.
So I was already going. I already had a hotel room, so I just went up and helped him out.
Right.
And did the little cameo deal there, too.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'd always wonder about that, because, you know, it's that montage of all the coaches, and like, oh, there he is, Nolan Richson, there he is.
Yeah.
Talking about your days as a player, you know, you played at Texas Western, which is now UTEP. What kind of player were you back in the day?
I was what you would call, when I started, 6'3", 6'2 and a half, 6'3 was like forward in our day. And 6'7", 6'8 was a big, big guy. We had one guy on our team like that. But when I started out, I was a scorer. Like, I started out at junior college and led team in scoring. And my sophomore year, I led the team in scoring, but there was games I couldn't play in because they had the rule no blacks could play on the floor in Louisiana at the time. Mm-hmm. And so, but I still averaged pretty close to 21 points a game myself. Then Haskins came in and changed the whole style of the play. You know, we were running and sticking the shots, and now we're more of a control team, walk it down. Mm-hmm. And I moved positions from a swing guy to maybe a two guard. And then the rules were you had to pass it inside, or you better not take the shot, or you sit down.
Right.
Yeah.
So I averaged, the next year I averaged 13 points a game as a junior. And then, but we won. And then my senior year was the first time in the history of that school going to the NCAA tournament.
Right.
I only averaged 10 points a game, but I guarded the best. So he made me a defensive, kind of what I did to McDaniel.
Right.
He made me more of a defensive-minded player as opposed to a guy who could stick it more. So I was, like I said, the thing that I thought I could do better than most was that I was a very good rebounder. I don't know why I was always where the ball was, but in junior college I averaged a double-double. When I was a sophomore, I was close to averaging a double-double. And I'd always get 8-9. I think my career is over 8 rebounds per game as a guard, you know. So, I was a very good offensive rebounder. That's how a lot of times I scored, but it's because I got the ball. I was stronger than most.
Right.
And I could, even though they might be tall and skinny, I could out-muscle them and take it back to the basket. So I used that as my strength was I never had to go on weights. They used to, all of our team members were on weight programs. They took me off the weight program. I used to cramp up. Because then back in those days, we weren't for sure if basketball players should be on weights.
Right.
And now,
everybody,
you don't live without
it. Yeah, exactly.
Huh.
Well, we obviously know you played basketball in college. You also played baseball, right?
Oh, yeah. That was my favorite sport.
Oh, your favorite
sport?
Oh, wow.
At the time. Because that's the only sport when you're growing up and you live in, and you guys wouldn't understand, but if you were growing up, you lived in the south side of El Paso. The only game that was organized was baseball, like Little League. Mm-hmm. It was organized. Why? Because they had uniforms and they had, you know, you had your team and they played we played two nights a week during the summer months. Basketball, you couldn't have played because there was no organizations of basketball leagues like they have for the kids today. They didn't have all of that. Mm-hmm. So in football, you had to wait till you were a freshman in high school before you got a chance to play, or seventh grade or junior high. Mm-hmm. So baseball, I started when I was 8. And I played it all the time, year-round, if I could. So that was my first love, was the baseball.
And the Astros offered you a minor league contract, right?
They did.
Is there a reason why you didn't want to take that?
Well, I wanted to go.
Okay.
But I would have had to leave school at my junior year.
Okay. Mm.
And my grandmother wouldn't sign. Back in those days, if you weren't 21, anything you did had to be signed by your parents.
Okay.
Even if you were married and you wasn't 21.
Really?
Yes.
And so
you still had to have your parents' signature.
So she wouldn't sign.
She would not sign.
So you couldn't go.
Because I wanted to go. I wanted to go, and they were going to send me to California back in the days when they had the C League and B League and D League.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to send me to Modesto, California. They were giving me, I think, $10,000 bonus. And well, back then, $10,000 would be like $100,000
today. Yeah.
Today.
Yeah.
But she wouldn't sign, so I had to go back to college. And I tell you what, it was going into my senior year. That's what it was, because he said, you only had 1 year to go to school. Mm-hmm. Well, you finish that, then you can go.
Mm-hmm.
So then when I finished it, the guy who offered me this money, they fired him.
Wow.
Then they brought in another guy. And when they brought in the other guy, he wanted me to go at half the price, and I went football instead.
Yeah, we read about that.
Because you tried for the Chargers, right?
Yeah.
What position did you try?
I was a wideout in high school.
Okay.
And, you know, had set all kinds of pass receiving records and what have you. So when I went to college, they kept trying to get me to play football, but I wouldn't. Because in those days, you could kind of double up. But I wouldn't do it. I only played baseball and basketball. So when I got out, my high school coach was a very close friend of the head coach with the San Diego Chargers. And that guy asked him about me. What happened to Richardson? I remember he could catch the ball and everything. And back in those days, they were getting basketball players to be defensive backs. So they drafted me and pulled me in as a corner. I tried to learn the cornerback spot.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, they had one of the greatest players on that team was a guy they called him Bambi, which was an Arkansas player. He said all kinds
of things. Yeah, Lance Allworth?
Yeah, he was on that team the year before I tried out there. So I went out there, and I pulled a hamstring
in
about the fourth workout.
That's
I was. I think I would. I was the guy that was my roommate. I was better than he was. He made the team.
Mm.
You know, after. Because it was only two of us left.
Right.
And I pulled a hamstring.
So it's all due to that hammy then.
The next thing you know, he's on the team. As a matter of fact, he makes all pro that year.
Oh, wow.
Really? I'm saying, damn, he made all pro.
You were better than him.
And I thought, and I knew I was going to beat him up. And he knew it too.
He's funny.
But, because in practice, you could tell, I took most of the downs, I'd be out on the defensive end. He'd be on the sideline.
Mm-hmm.
And then every now and then he'd come in. But when I went down and he was there, and he was a pretty good player. His name was Dick Westmoreland. He was he turned out to be pretty good. But we were roommates going through spring training.
So you were the one getting most of the reps at first, obviously.
Yeah, I was getting the reps.
Yeah.
And I felt that I was ahead of him.
He was probably thankful for that hanging.
Yeah. Yes. What was like an average contract at that time?
Well, I never forget my contract was $9,000. I got like $1,500 bonus for signing, and a $9,000 contract. You know, you have to make the team, though.
Right.
The same way it was in basketball. See, I went to basketball, too. Uh-huh. I went to the Dallas Chaparrales.
ABA?
ABA.
Okay.
That's the same, almost the same thing. About 90, I think it was $9,500 was your, if you make the team. Uh-huh. Yeah, same thing.
Oh. Hmm. Yeah, different time.
Yeah.
Now, you told us this was the first podcast interview you'd ever done. Are you interested in all social media, or do you just kind of let that pass by? You ever been on Facebook or Twitter? Or
no, I haven't been on either one. It's some, you know, when I was with the girls, they had a Twitter for me or a Facebook that the guy would come in and do everything, and right. then he put it on there.
Okay.
That's for the school. But, no, what I do a lot right now is that I'm involved with my daughter Yvonne's foundation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We raised, I got like 35 charities. And then this morning, I spent a lot of time preparing myself because I do a lot of speaking. And, I got to be in Houston. I mean, I just came from Houston a couple of months ago speaking to the lawyers, and I spoke to the judges at their banquets or something like that. So I do a lot of motivational speaking, mm-hmm. Trying to, you know, I try to take the life that I've lived, and it hasn't been the prettiest one, and gear it into, you know, my topic is, you know, if it is to be, it's up to me, and time is running out,
right.
You know, and I try to make people understand that I never lost the game. I never have. The time ran out. If they just put some more time on the clock, that's the way it is in life. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're not careful, time will run out.
Right.
And when time stops in life, you're dead. Mm-hmm. So time does run out.
Right.
And in every sport that we play, time will run out. Mm-hmm. Whether it's 9 innings, 40 minutes of hell, 40 minutes, mm-hmm. or the football game, time's going to eventually get you. So you're always against the clock.
Right.
And in real life, and in this real life that we're in, we're against the clock right now.
Mm-hmm. It's the most valuable thing, I feel like, is time. Always. Always, always wish for more time.
Right.
More
and time. I know you knew Matt Turner.
I
worked with Matt Turner for many years. Great guy, you know. Passed away about a month ago. What memories do you have of Matt?
Matt to me was a super, super young guy. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people, let's say, like Matt, I knew Paul Eels.
Right.
You know, there was a guy in Tulsa named Jerry Weber. They're those kind of special people that they're not out to hurt anyone. They're going to get the facts the best they can, and they're going to, well, whenever they got the news, it is not like hearsay. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you put your spin on it. Mm-hmm. This is what happens, and this is the way it was. And that's how I saw Matt doing his job. Mm-hmm. He was doing his job, and his job didn't have to have anything to do with trying to hurt anyone. He had a job to do, and that's how I saw him. And it's not a lot of folks that are like that anymore, mm-hmm. especially this day and age.
Right.
Hey, everybody's trying to make a mark, and some people don't care how they make that mark. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be backhanded, a slide, it don't matter, as long as they make their mark. Well, I never saw Matt that way. Like I said, Paul Eels was a gentleman. Gentleman's gentleman.
Right.
You know, when you saw him, you felt good when you saw. There are people that you see that you don't really care to see.
Yeah.
You know, and there's people that you can see and you say, man, I really enjoy being around him.
Right.
Well, Matt was like that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I don't know if it's a gift of the good man upstairs that has made it where it's so easy to communicate or talk with him. You know that when you say something, like, for example, the thing that I used to listen to guys would tell me, this is off the record, Coach, can you?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Off the record. Nothing's off the record.
Right.
But now, with Matt, if he said it, it was off the record. Mm-hmm. You see, that's what I'm saying. That's the kind of difference. That if Paul Eels say, hey, coach, this happened. Can you tell me this? It's off the record. Mm-hmm. I would tell him.
Right.
Because, you know, that's the kind of respect and trust you had in the guy. That's how Matt was to me.
Right, yeah. He was the first guest on this podcast. He was the first guy I wanted to interview when I started this. And we talked for probably an hour and a half. And, you know, he spoke greatly of you. And, you know, I'm sure if he was here right now, he'd be tickled to death to know that I was interviewing you at your house. He'd probably be like, what are you going to say? You got everything ready? You know, you got your questions? But, yeah
that's
a great guy, yeah.
Yeah. We're going to, like I said, those kind of people you miss, they put a void in you in the things that you're going to be missing. But, yeah, he's, no question, he was one of my favorite guys. You know, he could call me, and I might be going to do something. So, okay, Matt, I'll get it done, man. You know, he was that kind of guy.
Right. I think that's probably a great place to stop there, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Coach, thank you for your time. We really appreciate it.
You got it,
that was
man.
Great.
Hey, we appreciate it.
You got it, guys.
Don't forget, you can follow the show on Twitter at Stoppage Time Pod, or like us on Facebook, Stoppage Time with Hayden Herrera. Once again, our thanks to Coach for joining us. This has been Stoppage Time. I'm Hayden Herrera, and we'll see you next week.